WBR News. It's now 9:06.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange.
I want you all to know about a decision I've made. Starting today, I am a candidate for the United States Senate for the state of New Hampshire.
After dispensaries are open, it will only benefit patients in outlying areas. But for now, for the patients who can't afford to wait a year or two or more, and who knows how long it'll actually take, that's what this bill is about. That's what we're trying to draw attention to.
My sense is that the Senate has moved to a compromise by coming to this place, and we want to recognize their hard work. We want to recognize their compromise and work together with them on this.
At this point, looking at just numbers from a handful of skiers, it's looking really good. Last year was our fifth best winter on record, and this winter we're tracking relatively even with that. So I think we're going to see successful numbers when we tally them up.
It's a way for me, you know, I've never done this before, obviously, to hear what people have to say. I have an agenda which people in Vermont are familiar with, but most people around the country are not familiar with. And I want to hear people's input. Do they share my feelings? And this is an opportunity to do that in New Hampshire.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. And from the top, that was Scott Brown making his much-anticipated announcement of his candidacy for the U.S. Senate. Advocate Matt Simon speaking in favor of certain patients growing their own medical marijuana while they wait for state-sanctioned dispensaries to open. Speaker of the House Terry Norelli predicting passage of a 4-cent gas tax increase. Carl Stone, marketing director of Ski New Hampshire, assessing this year's lucrative season. And Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders on his presidential exploration, which begins in the Granite State this weekend. Again, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. Let's hear from you as we examine these and other headlines, including a Senate committee vote yesterday to repeal the death penalty. It's still very uncertain how the full Senate might vote. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Our guests on this week's roundup are Kevin Landrigan, longtime political reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua. Kevin, great to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
Also with us, Kathleen Ronayne, State House and politics reporter for the Concord Monitor. And Kathleen, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
And as always, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, thanks for taking time out.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, and Dean, I'll start with you because this is a political story, a big political headline last night on New Hampshire's Seacoast. Scott Brown making his long-awaited announcement that he's running for Jeanne Shaheen's Senate seat this year. What did he say, Dean, beyond the obvious that, yes, I'm running?
Yes, it is now officially on. He had a nice turnout, nice sized crowd, a lot of enthusiasm. He did a couple different things. The first thing he tried to do was kind of shore up his New Hampshire credentials, talked a lot about visiting family in New Hampshire as a child, his sort of long relationship with New Hampshire. And it's going to be one of the real challenges for him is to sort of avoid the kind of carpetbagger label by showing that he really is part of the political culture here. And, you know, he may have connections to New Hampshire, but I can say he has not been a part of the political discourse in the state for at least the last 20 years. He may have been a property owner. He may have come up here as a kid. And that's going to be a challenge for him is to weave a political narrative that resonates with people in the state. So that was the first thing he did. The other thing he did was to begin the task of tying Jeanne Shaheen to President Obama. He talked about her voting record in the Senate being almost in perfect sync with President Obama. He talked about her support of Obamacare and the need to repeal Obamacare. He tried to sort of present himself as an independent. It's interesting. He didn't come out as a hardcore conservative. He said, I'm kind of an independent fellow. And his record in the Senate, brief as it was, seems to back that up. and made the argument that that may resonate with a lot of independents in New Hampshire who are concerned that Senator Shaheen has drifted too close to a somewhat unpopular president. So those were his tasks. Talk about New Hampshire, tie Gene Shaheen to President Obama, and focus a lot actually on just talking about repealing Obamacare in general.
Well, and Kevin, to you, you know, Democrats certainly are going to use the carpetbagger label a lot for Scott Brown, but how much does that really matter to state Republicans? You heard the word electability a lot last night.
Yeah, and of course, as we know, in primaries, electability really, that and, you know, a buck and a half will get you a cup of coffee at Dunkin' Donuts. Electability just doesn't matter in the primary to primary voters. It regardless of whether it shows up in polls, that's not why people vote to nominate someone in a primary. They generally do that because they have faith in that person, and they often agree with that person. That's what would be the difficult challenge here for Scott Brown. I think really to try and strike that balance between someone who portrays himself to be conservative enough to be the Republican nominee, because he has three opponents in a Republican primary, two who are clearly much more conservative than he is, former Senator Bob Smith and Karen Testaman, an activist, former candidate for governor, both very conservative, socially very conservative. Jim Rubin's the third candidate is not. So, but Brown's, this isn't his first rodeo. He's run for the U.S. Senate twice before. He understands that while he tries to appeal to conservative voters, as Dean pointed out, the independents are the cash cow in New Hampshire electorate. So you have to stay in the middle of the road during the primary season, and he's going to try and do that.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned the other candidates who are running, Bob Smith, Karen Testaman, Jim Rubins, and Kathleen Ronayne, to you. The three of them got together for their first U.S. Senate debate in Bedford Tuesday night. Give us a sense of what that event was like.
Well, I think that for them to all get together without Brown, they all kind of made this point that he decided not to show up, even though I believe they invited him. I think it's going to be tricky at the beginning for them to differentiate themselves from each other, because all of the talk right now is against Brown, and they're all trying to show why he is the wrong candidate. I would say that Jim Rubins is the only one who's really talking past Brown right now. Bob Smith is putting out a lot of releases focused on Scott Brown and why he's better than Brown. Jim Rubins is focusing on why he's better than Shaheen.
That's interesting.
But I think that the three of them coming together, it was a chance for them to stand against Brown, try and differentiate themselves from each other. As Kevin mentioned, Karen Testerman and Bob Smith are more socially conservative than Jim Rubins. You know, it gives them a chance to all point to their own records. Bob Smith is really going to point to his time as a senator, saying, I know what it means to be in Congress. I've been there. I understand how it works. My opponents don't. Jim Rubins, you know, has been touring across the state on charter schools, on the Second Amendment, issues that are popular with Republican primary voters. So it was a chance for them all to kind of introduce themselves. It probably didn't get quite as much attention as they were all hoping it would, because the big event this week was Scott Brown. And that's going to be the problem for them, trying to pull attention onto themselves and away from Brown.
Our number here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Join us as we cover some of the top headlines of the week at 1-800-892-6477. Two more quick political stories, folks. And Dean Spiliotis, to you, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders coming to New Hampshire this weekend to possibly look at running for president.
Yes, and as we heard in the opening montage, he is quite openly exploring the possibility of running for president. Bernie Sanders is 72. He's an independent. He describes himself as a Democratic socialist. He caucuses with Democrats in the U.S. Senate. You know, for people who live in the region, he's been around politics for a long, long time. He was in the U.S. House from 1988 to 2004, then ran in the U.S. Senate and won, and was recently reelected in 2012. So he's a veteran politician. Now, you know, I feel comfortable saying that Sanders is not going to be the Democratic nominee for president. But that said, he does have an opportunity to influence the discourse. I mean, I think he's going to run a kind of a grassroots progressive campaign. And in every presidential cycle, there's usually one or two candidates. You know, I'm thinking of a ways back, Gary Bauer in the Republican presidential race, Al Sharpton in the Democratic presidential race. You get these individuals who are very passionate. They're very outspoken. They can have a real impact on the campaign discourse. They can put the sort of front-running candidates in a difficult position. You know, he's not going to be the nominee, but there's certainly room for him to have an impact in the conversation.
Yeah, just like Ron Paul has done
Ron
in several Paul's presidential primaries.
Ron Paul's another great
primaries.
Example, absolutely.
Sure. And Kevin, a big political story that just developed yesterday. This concerns Rockingham County Attorney Jim Reams, who's been suspended for many months now from his office. Superior Court Judge McNamara yesterday reinstated Reams, called the Attorney General's decision to suspend him unlawful. That's pretty strong language.
Yeah, it certainly is. I think Michael Ramsdell, who is a former state prosecutor, who was a Jim Reams attorney, really was very confident going into the oral arguments on this case. He really felt that because the Attorney General's office waited until less than a month ago to release its report, its first report publicly on Jim Reams' behavior, and essentially said, hey, there's a lot of kind of untoward things that happened in the Rockingham County Attorney's Office, but we didn't find any breaking of criminal law. And I think Judge McNamara essentially made both a legal and a political judgment here. I think first he's, as has been done in the past in state courts, the Attorney General's power to remove sitting public officials is limited. And
because this person is chosen by the voters.
That's
so
correct.
A special...
So, right. And so you have to the judicial branch is obviously going to respect that person's right to remain in office, particularly as long as they're not under criminal indictment. And he is not. The political judgment is that Judge McNamara well understands this is going to the state Supreme Court. He also well understands that Jim Reams is not running for re-election. And there's only a finite period of months he's going to be serving in office, no matter how this comes out.
All right. Well, in just a moment, two big stories in the legislature this week that I want to catch up with you folks on. One is another casino bill heard in the House this week. Kathleen, I'll ask you about that. And then all of you, a renewed effort in the state Senate to add a grow your own option to the state's medical marijuana laws. We'll talk about those in just a moment. We invite your questions, comments, thoughts at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. More in a moment.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. You can make sure your membership gift to NHPR goes as far as it can with our corporate match program. Many businesses around the state match their employees' donations to NHPR. You can essentially double the impact of your membership gift. Find out if your company participates at nhpr.org. More of the New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup of the week's top national stories. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank. Customized business banking for businesses, professionals, municipalities, and not-for-profit organizations. Online at centrixbank.com. From German Auto Works in Concord, servicing Volkswagen, Audi, and now BMW, welcoming technician Jody McCormack with 16 years BMW service experience. Details at 228-2834. And Granite State Human Resource Conference, Tuesday, April 29th, at the Center of New Hampshire in Manchester. Information and registration online at gshrconference.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're covering some of the top stories that made headlines this week, including a bill to allow certain patients to grow their own medical marijuana while they wait for state-sanctioned dispensaries to open. Also, there's been more discussion about a new casino bill in the House, and then an interesting reversal of fortunes for the death penalty repeal bill in the state Senate this week. We're catching up on all those stories and a lot more. We invite your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange. All one word. Our guests are Kathleen Ronayne. She's with the Concord Monitor, Kevin Landrigan with the Telegraph of Nashua, and Dean Spiliotis, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Kathleen, I did want to ask you about the casino bill, the latest casino bill, now before the House Ways and Means Committee. This is very confusing for folks who don't follow this every day. Didn't we hear about the House killing a casino bill earlier this year? Why are we talking about this again?
We did. The bill that the House killed was a bill to legalize one casino. This bill that's coming up is a bill to legalize two casinos, and it originated in the Senate, which is why it's now coming to the House. It is a bill sponsored by Lou D'Alessandro, a senator from Manchester who has been a casino advocate for a very long time. So I think that he wanted to, introduce a bill that was the best version of the bill to him. So he introduced it in the Senate. And I think that even though the House shut down the one casino proposal, there are things that are different about this bill. And it's making the casino supporters think that they might as well give it one more try because they might be able to get more people on board. In addition to being two casinos instead of one, which is clearly a major difference, it also restores a revenue sharing provision that the legislature eliminated during the economic downturn.
So that's a big sweetener.
Yes. And that's – I think that senators who are in favor of the casino bill are thinking that it's going to be just that, a sweetener that might get some wary House members on board. It's $25.2 million that would be split amongst all the communities annually. So it would be some property tax relief. So I think that they're hoping that they will get some more people on board. Also, there were a handful of libertarian Republicans who did not like the idea of one casino being a monopoly. They might be able to get a few more people on board with this one. It's still going to be a tough fight. And there was a hearing yesterday where we heard a lot of anti-casino people saying that the revenue sharing was just a false promise that we've seen before. The legislature can take it away if they want. So we're putting it in here as a sweetener. But how do we know you're not going to get rid of it in just a few years? So there are new elements to this. It is getting a little tired, though. You know, the debate lasted for, I think, more than 4 hours yesterday. And most of the arguments were arguments that we have heard over and over again from people that have been arguing about this for months and years. So it's definitely feeling a little tired at this point. But there are a few differences, and we'll see what happens.
All right. Well, and we'll be following up with a program on this new, sweetened, revised, whatever you want to call it, casino legislation in about a week. So more on that a little bit later. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And all of you, before we turn to the medical marijuana issue, Dean Spiliotis, here's an email that came in from Christopher in Manchester. He says, thanks for mentioning that there actually is a Republican primary. The national media hardly mentions it. Already has the race framed. Christopher says, Jim Rubens has been working very hard for a long time and shouldn't be dismissed. Christopher, thank you for the email.
Yeah, this is going to be the challenge for actually both Scott Brown and the other candidates. To some extent, it's in Scott Brown's interest to essentially ignore the other candidates. He's a high-profile national candidate. He's going to get a lot of free media attention as a result. The media has, to an extent, framed it as a choice between Shaheen and Brown, even though he has not yet won the Republican nomination. On the other hand, the other candidates have to kind of be careful about, they have to make the case that they deserve attention as well. But sort of how you do it kind of it reflects on your seriousness as a candidate. So, they don't want to give Scott Brown too much credit for stealing the limelight. So it's a balancing act on both sides. You know, we'll see Republican debates in September. There will be opportunities. Scott Brown hadn't officially announced, even though he was invited to that debate. It's not really in his interest at this point to jump into a debate with them. I think he's going to try to minimize kind of acknowledging them as much as possible. But he also has to look like he plays well with others. If he completely disses them, that's a danger as well.
All right. Well, Christopher, thanks for the email. Again, the email address is exchange@nhpr.org. The phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Two bills that we really should get to. Medical marijuana first. Kevin Landrigan, the Senate Health and Human Services Committee heard testimony earlier this week. Some groups, including patients, are pushing for changes to the current medical marijuana law. Now, what are the issues here, Kevin?
Well, as we've talked about before, New Hampshire became, at the time, the 19th state to legalize medical marijuana. But it really set up a very elongated system for creating the sale of medical marijuana to chronically ill patients over a year for the state agencies to develop rules, another 6 to 9 months for a bidding process for up to 4 dispensaries where you'll be able to purchase this marijuana. that's just not fast enough for folks who have chronically ill conditions and want to get support. It's also not what the community that supported this legislation wanted, after all, as we've talked about. They wanted a homegrown option, the ability of patients and caregivers to be able to grow their own. In all likelihood, medical insurance not going to cover this, so the purchase of the medical marijuana could be very expensive. So they pursued this legislation, essentially allowed this a limited kind of homegrown option, particularly for people who live are going to live more than 30 miles away from these dispensaries.
Yeah, because it's only four, right?
Kind right. Of, yeah. So even in a small state such as ours, where you would imagine they're probably going to concentrate the dispensaries where most of the people are in the southern tier, you could have some folks in the upper western and northern parts of the state have to drive a lot more than 30 miles to get to one.
Now, Kathleen, Governor Hassan, the last time we talked about this, was pretty firm, no grow your own. Is she changing her mind this year?
I have not heard her change her mind. I think that she has pretty much stayed out of this debate so far. I think it's going to depend on what happens in the Senate. I think it's going to be probably tough for it to get through the Senate. I mean, I would say it probably has a chance, but I think
Senate rejected it last time.
Yeah,
right?
they rejected it last time. So I haven't heard anything on the governor change. She definitely hasn't changed her mind. I don't think she said too much at all. So I think it's kind of a wait and see probably on her end to see how this plays out in the Senate.
Dean.
Yeah, I mean, it would be interesting to see if she will, if there's enough support similar to, you know, pass the House quite easily, if there's enough support in the Senate, if maybe she'll soften a little bit. But it's interesting that, you know, that even with this sort of temporary fix, I think, as Kevin mentioned, for some people, it may put them in a position of sort of permanently being able to grow their own. But also, I mean, even the implementation of this could potentially be problematic and take a while as well. So, I mean, I understand the time is of the essence, and you may very well get some people who are just going to take their chances and grow their own because they need it because of their medical conditions. But, you know, when we were talking about this bill last year, this whole issue of kind of the phase-in and then the legalization argument on top of that, it just takes some time, and it'll be interesting to see if the Senate kind of breaks the logjam on this.
Yeah, I don't think, and I don't think Governor Hassan can afford to change her position now. This is the deal she essentially made with law enforcement, which was, I support the concept of these folks having access to it. I agree with you that the homegrown, however, is a security risk. It's very difficult to control. So she can't be supportive of this. I think behind the scenes, she's going to talk to a number of Democratic senators. She does not want this bill on her desk. She certainly doesn't want to have to veto it. She will if she has to. But in election year, that's a really uncomfortable thing to do for a Democrat.
She'll have to look like the bad guy.
Right.
Or gal. Right. The phone number again here on The Exchange for the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477. We'd love to hear from you on some of the stories that we're covering this week, whether it's changes or proposed changes to the medical marijuana law, a new casino bill coming before the House, the emerging U.S. race for New Hampshire's U.S. Senate seat. Join us on these headlines and others, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. And all of you, there was an interesting twist just yesterday in the state Senate on the death penalty. Kathleen, something happened in the Judiciary Committee just yesterday afternoon. What was it?
Yes. So earlier this week, the Senate Judiciary Committee took a vote on the death penalty repeal bill. It was 2-2. Senator Donna Susie of Manchester was not able to be there. She was on her way, but got caught up in traffic. I think she intended to be there. She didn't just skip the vote. But
yeah, I think she said her father had a medical emergency.
So she missed it, and it was 2-2. And in the Senate, when a committee vote is tied, it goes into the full body with a recommendation to kill the bill. It's the opposite in the House. If it's a tie, it would be to pass, I believe.
Yep.
So the committee reconsidered the vote yesterday so that Senator Susie would have a chance to weigh in. And she voted the death penalty repeal ought to pass. So it's now 3-2, which means it goes in with an ought to pass recommendation. I think that some people were a little unsure about how Senator Susie might vote. She is from Manchester, which is, of course, where Michael Briggs was a police officer. It's a big issue there. And one of the questions around the death penalty repeal bill has been whether or not it you know, would truly be prospective. All laws are prospective, but would it be possible really to execute Michael Addison if the repeal went in place. And actually, Senator Ayotte was doing a radio interview this week. She, of course, tried the Addison case when she was attorney general. And she said on the radio that she thinks it is absurd, this idea that they would vote for a death penalty repeal and think that it would not affect Michael Addison's sentence. We also have to remember the Supreme Court is still weighing whether that was a fair sentence or not. So I think there's a concern that if, you know, the Senate decides to pass a death penalty repeal bill and we know the governor will sign it before the Supreme Court weighs in, could that affect their decision? I don't know. And I think that's what Senator Ayotte was saying. So I think it's a complicated issue. I think people were unsure maybe about where Senator Susie would vote. And I still think it's going to be hard, I think, for it to pass the Senate. There's one Republican who is on record as definitely supporting it. That's Sam Cataldo.
Supporting repeal.
And if all the Democrats vote for it, which I think there's a big question also by Senator D'Alessandro, he's always been pretty vocal that he's against repeal. Even if you had all 11 Democrats and Senator Cataldo, it's 12-12 and repeal doesn't pass. So it's, I think it's going to be surprising if it does pass the Senate.
And is this next week, Kathleen?
When the full Senate votes on this? They're going to vote on Thursday.
Okay, a big deal. A lot of nose counting there. Kevin Landrigan, you know, you've covered the legislature for a long time. Have you seen lawmakers, in this case state senators, change their opinions at the 11th hour on this?
It's unusual, certainly, particularly on social issues, for folks to have a change of heart. I've seen it happen before. But it's not the norm. I think it's harder to do in an election year as well. Senate President Chuck Morris is a strong opponent of repealing the death penalty. And I think we saw really a fairly deft move by him tactically with regard to this bill. Basically, the House passed this a short time ago, and President Morris really had two choices. He could have the bill sit in the Senate for a while and essentially let the organizers of repeal to reach out to those senators, or he could bring it to the Senate quickly and try and get his result. Like you said, make it harder for senators to have enough time to articulate, oh, yeah, I've really changed my mind. That's why he did it, and I agree with Kathleen. That did not improve the prospects for passing this. Even supporters said, a lot of senators essentially said to the repeal movement, let's wait until it comes out of the House. I'm still thinking about it. In politics, that's sort of code for, I don't want a lot of time to have to give you the bad news that I'm going to be against your bill. You know, it's never a good sign when folks kind of brush you off on an issue like this. And I haven't heard of any other Republicans to this point who are willing to be defectors. But certainly Rennie Cushing, the Hampton Democrat who's organizing this movement, remains optimistic that he's going to be able to pick off a couple.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens. Yeah. Again, the number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Dean, just very quickly to you, the debate here, you know, we're all focused on counting heads at the State House, but this has gotten national, even international attention. The head of Amnesty International has been looking at this. What do you make of this in terms of a big national story?
Yeah, you know, the death penalty is one of those issues where kind of American sentiment on it changes slowly over time in response to kind of bigger trends and evidence and anecdotal evidence of about various cases being overturned. You know, there have been arguments that it's unequally applied based on race, that now that we have DNA testing, we're finding out that a number of people on death row shouldn't actually be there. But in the end, this really kind of comes down to a kind of a vote based on principle. You know, there are cost issues. It I think for the Addison case, they've spent $4 or $5 million already on both sides in total. But people typically don't vote based on cost. It comes down to kind of a personal belief. But again, these sort of beliefs and sentiments seem to sort of change slowly over time. And right now, we're in a period in the country where people are sort of questioning whether it's the right way to go. But there still are obviously proponents of the death penalty. You know, the reality in New Hampshire is there hasn't been an execution since 1938, 1939, and we have a the statute we have is fairly narrow as it is. But I think Kathleen was right to point out Senator Ayotte's comment that you know, the idea that you repeal it, but it's not going to affect the Addison case. I mean, that's a legitimate legal question about whether that may not be true.
Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Well, there was some happy news, Kathleen Ronayne, for New Hampshire's ski industry. Seems kind of obvious. There was a lot of snow. It was really cold. The ski industry is smiling. Give us a little bit more, please, Kathleen.
Yeah, the ski industry, they had a great season this year. I think they said that their revenues were matching last year, which was one of the top 5 years in history or something like that. Of course, we had dumps of snow over and over again that I think a lot of us weren't happy about. But for skiers, it's great when you see – when you know there's fresh snow out there. You're not dealing with something coming out of the machine. So I think it's good for New Hampshire. I also think, you know, just covering the Statehouse, we hear lawmakers talk all the time about our tourism industry and how important it is and how much revenue it generates. So this is, you know, great for lawmakers and for everyone in New Hampshire to look at all this money that we're bringing in through our ski industry. And I believe that the ski groups also did an impact study that showed there was a ton of money being spent outside of the ski resorts,
right,
too. So at local
– people buy clothes. Yeah, they go to restaurants. They go
at restaurants
shopping.
And businesses. So it's not just the ski industries that benefit from this. It really is the entire tourism industry in New Hampshire, the towns and cities around those ski areas. So very good news, I would say, for the New Hampshire economy and for skiers.
White gold, they
yes.
call it when it snows. And Dean, speaking of happy economic stories, there were some numbers that came out about how confident Granite Staters are feeling about New Hampshire business. They're feeling pretty good from what we hear.
That's right. This is a UNH poll. I believe it was done for the Business Industry Association of New Hampshire. The poll found that 54% of New Hampshire residents think the state is headed for good business conditions over the next 12 months. And this is the highest level of confidence we've seen in this polling data since July of 2005.
Wow, almost 10 years.
Yes, yes. The interesting thing, of course, is they're not so confident when it comes to the overall U.S. picture. Only 38% of New Hampshireites who were polled believe the U.S. overall is headed for good times. 41% say bad times are more likely. So as is often the case in New Hampshire, where the economic picture has generally been a little bit better than the national picture, people are optimistic here, but less so about the overall economic climate. If I could just say one thing about the skiing industry, I'm someone, I've skied for about 40 years, so I've watched the industry evolve. What's so fascinating about the financial picture is, A, the snowmaking infrastructure is so much better now that they're buffered a little bit, and they've also started to develop kind of a summertime usage with
yes,
zip lines,
right,
alpine slides,
mountain biking.
It's really changed the whole dynamic of the industry, and that, you know, that's something that they can use in rough weather.
All right. More after a short break. Stay with us.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the government for the first time releases data on Medicare payments. President Obama vows to do more for war veterans at a memorial for Fort Hood shooting victims. Then pro-Russian separatists take over government buildings in eastern Ukraine. All coming up on The Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from A&B Lumber and Home Centers, featuring windows and doors by Marvin and Integrity for remodeling or replacement projects in Pembroke, Moultonboro, and at ablumber.com. And the University of New Hampshire Online Master of Social Work program, now accepting applications for August admission, mswonline.unh.edu. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're covering some of the top headlines this week, including recent good news for the state's ski industry, also bills in the legislature on medical marijuana, a grow-your-own option, also New Hampshire's death penalty repeal debate attracting national and even international attention. Lots of questions about how the full Senate might vote on the death penalty. We've also been talking a lot about the emerging Republican race for the U.S. Senate to challenge Jeanne Shaheen this fall. The number for you to join us with your thoughts, questions, comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. 892-6477. Kevin Landrigan, I wanted to ask you about another election year issue. This is so-called paycheck fairness. Governor Hassan signed a proclamation earlier this week calling for equal pay for women. From what I understand, Kevin, this is a big sort of Democratic rallying cry for the fall elections.
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly President Obama's the chief architect of this, essentially understands full well that the support of women had much to do with him winning in 2008 and winning in 2012. And the defection of women, particularly on fiscal conservative issues, had a lot to do with the losses in 2010, Republican gains in states like New Hampshire and across the country. They feel this is a pretty good wedge issue, that and this is not an unfamiliar topic by this president. He's talked about discrimination against women in the workplace since before he was president. In this legislation, former Governor Jean Shaheen, the first woman governor in the state of New Hampshire, first woman elected to statewide office in New Hampshire, was the architect of a law against discrimination against women in the workplace. This really strengthens that law, and it essentially says that employers can't retaliate against any employee who discusses their salary at work.
So it's not a bill, Kathleen, saying, you know, you and Kevin have to make the same salary. It's just saying, if you and Kevin worked at the same organization, which you don't, that you and Kevin could talk about it if you thought he might be paid more than you, and you wouldn't get in trouble for doing that. Is that what this is about? It's not setting down dollar numbers saying you must.
No, it doesn't set down dollar numbers. The no retaliation for speaking about your wages is a big piece of it. But I believe what it also does is it makes a little bit more specific the reasons why employers can pay people different wages. So I think the law before kind of, you know, vaguely said any reason not related to gender is why you might be able to pay two people different things. But I think that this new law, I believe it spells it out a little more clearly. So you can pay people different men and women different wages if they have a different level of expertise, if they if their job descriptions are different. I mean, things that seem obvious,
education,
but it spells it out
so forth,
in the
yeah.
law a little bit more. So it puts a little bit more of a burden on employers to prove what the reason is for why they're paying men and women differently if a case were to be brought. It also extends the time period for which people can bring forth complaints. Under the current law, you can only bring forth a complaint up to 1 year after the discrimination occurred. Under this new version of the law, you could bring forth a complaint up to 3 years after you discovered that the violation occurred. So, you know, you might leave an organization, get your last paycheck before you only have a year from the date of that last paycheck. But under this law, say you don't find out until 6 months after you're done being employed there that you are making something different. You have 3 years from that 6 month date that you found out. So it extends the time period. I also think just in terms of politics, while nationally this is a big issue for Democrats, and I think Democrats here are going to be talking about it a lot. You know, we saw a huge Democratic-backed press conference this week at the State House. But we have to remember that this passed the New Hampshire Senate unanimously.
Right.
So all of the Republicans backed it. So at least from the Senate perspective, it's not like Democrats have the ability to say, you know, the two parties are apart here, because even, you know, the most conservative Republicans in the Senate voted for this. So taking away the ability of the Democrats a little bit to make this a wedge issue.
Interesting dynamic. I'm glad you mentioned that, Kathleen. And that's different from what we see on Capitol Hill, Dean, or not?
Well, I mean, Capitol Hill, the issue has been couched more in terms of sort of the minimum wage debate, a minimum wage debate, which I think is going to be a wedge issue, as Kevin said. You know, this is it's an interesting issue. I don't think a lot of people realize that, you know, employers might retaliate if you discuss salary with your coworkers or try to get a sense of what other people are making. You know, President Obama did have the Equal Pay Day at the White House with Lilly Ledbetter, who was a litigant after working at a Goodyear plant for many years. It's a, you know, no one wants to be seen as being in favor of wage discrimination. You typically hear sort of larger arguments from Republicans about the impact of minimum wage and sort of government interference and letting the market decide.
All right. Well, and I do want to ask all of you about a story that's been big on social media. A popular substitute teacher fired for being too popular on Facebook. This is in the Claremont area. So I want to ask you all about that in just a moment. But Kevin Landergan, just take a minute here with me, if you could, please, to remember that it's been 6 months since Kennett High School student Abigail Hernandez disappeared. The case is ongoing, devastating for her family to mark this six-month anniversary. How did this story begin, Kevin, and do we know anything about where it stands now?
Yeah, it really started as kind of a just a sad, almost bizarre mystery, and that's where it's remained. I mean, she was last seen heading home from school. The authorities have extensively searched both the area where she was and also a number of places up in North Conway that unfortunately you'd probably describe as potential dump sites for a body. They've looked up there as well. What's really added to this mystery actually was about a month after she went missing, her mother received a letter from Abigail Hernandez, and it's been very difficult, actually, for the media to really get a handle on where this story is going. I think it speaks to maybe it's very difficult for investigators to get a handle on where this story is going. I mean, even to this date, 6 months later, investigators still really won't acknowledge whether she was abducted or whether she is left of her own accord. And because we don't have this letter, we can probably presume there may well be some clues in that letter as to what happened to her and how she viewed her being away from her family.
All right. Well, we will keep our fingers crossed tightly for Abigail and her family. It's very difficult. I did want to ask you all about a substitute teacher, a story of a substitute teacher at Stevens High School in Claremont, seemingly being too popular with the kids. What's the story, Kathleen?
Yes, so a longtime substitute teacher, I believe she's 79 years old, she had 250 students, former students, as Facebook friends. So it became an issue. The school told her that she wasn't complying with their policies. They had a rule that no teachers could be Facebook friends with students. And, you know, she said, well, I'm not doing anything wrong here. And she refused to comply. And so she is no longer a substitute teacher there. She said even if they decided to hire her back or change their mind, she wouldn't want to go back. So I think it raises a lot of really interesting questions about how public schools deal with social media these days. I know when I was covering Concord High last year, they were in the midst of developing a social media policy because there are suddenly all these new questions about when is it appropriate for teachers to interact with students on Facebook? What about Twitter? What about email? Do we need to have rules about this? And I think that some people, you know, might look at the case of the substitute teacher and say, you know, she's not doing anything wrong. She's just trying to, interact in a very innocent way with students. But this is an issue that you can't necessarily take on a case-by-case basis. You have to think more broadly that if you allow one teacher to do it, do you have to allow all teachers to do it? And when does it cross the line? And I also think, you know, there are more questions with social media than just being Facebook friends. In colleges, what a lot of professors do is they'll get students to organize, like they'll create a Facebook page for their class and they'll get discussions and organization and things like that going. Is that okay in high school? Should we be encouraging students to use that as a means of communication? When can the teacher be involved? And these are all questions that Concord High was trying to work through as they were developing their policy. So, and also, to what extent should the school be communicating with social media to parents? You know, should schools have Twitter and Facebook accounts where they're putting out information? It's a really complicated issue. And I think that if schools don't have social media policies, this case shows them that they need to think about developing them because it's only going to get more complicated.
Well, we got an email this morning from Ray in Whitefield, really thoughtful email. Ray says, I'm a retired former teacher and served on the White Mountain Regional District School Board. He says, as you are well aware, every organization has policies, guides to appropriate behavior, and when a person accepts employment, one of the requirements is to adhere to those guidelines. As a former teacher within the district, I would assume the teacher was aware of the policy regarding befriending students on Facebook. If so, Ray says, the district had every right to fire the person if she did not comply with district policy. Ray says, when I was a young teacher, an old timer gave me this piece of advice. Ray, you can be friendly, courteous, respectful to your students, but you are not their friend. And there's a little bit more, Ray. I won't take the time to read it now. Thank you so much for that. What do you think, Dean? You teach students.
Sure. Yes. I found this very interesting. I am probably not as sympathetic with a substitute teacher as she would like. I'm more in Ray's camp. I've been teaching for about 20 years. I teach students who are 18 and older, so it's a little bit of a different issue
because
they are adults. They're not minors.
But still.
But nonetheless, every university I've ever taught at has what they call an anti-fraternization policy. I think this is an example of technology just kind of getting ahead of school policy. It is a challenge. You have to establish, sort of boundaries. I think that, friendly versus being friends is a reasonable way to put it. I saw the teacher interview, and she talked about kind of being grandmotherly and having the kids over to talk about their problems and stuff. I think that's fine for her to do that as a private citizen, but as an employee of the school, I think it raises some issues. So, again, I think that schools have to sort of adapt their policies with changes in technology. Kathleen's Facebook example, at SNHU, we have a web portal and software that allows us to set up these virtual communities with our students, but it's licensed by the university. You enter it through the university portal. It's not this sort of separate thing going on in Facebook. So so they do think about these sorts of issues.
All right. Well, speaking of Facebook, Kevin Landrigan, on Facebook, some New Hampshire teens are challenging each other to take the polar plunge and then post their experiences on Facebook. New Hampshire school officials say they're kind of worried about this. So what's the polar plunge? And are we talking about, three kids or 300 kids?
Yeah, I think that the concern certainly educators is, and this is, again, one of these stories where new technology, if taken to the extreme, can pose some real concerns. There have been fundraisers in New Hampshire. There's one on the seacoast, very popular one, very well sanctioned. Where every year where folks jump into the sea in order to raise money for good causes.
Right, often on January 1st.
Right.
And like you said, it raises money for all sorts of, yeah.
Right, and that is very very well policed and very secure in a kind of very secure location. There are doctors on staff, for example, for folks when they come out of the water. I think that's actually the concern that administrators have here is that if this kind of activity becomes very popular, it can become very easily uncontrollable.
You might get hypothermic, and
right.
There's no EMT standing by.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
so.
And again, for folks who've encountered this, either as reporters or family members or what have you, hypothermia, both in the water and out of the water, can be extremely very mysterious and very violently serious health problem. You can appear in very good shape medically, and then soon after be in danger of losing your life.
Wow, things just start to shut down
very fast.
All right, well, very interesting. The polar plunge. Luckily, it's getting a little bit warmer, so
yes.
Maybe we won't have to worry about this for a while. Speaking of worry, Dean Spiliotis, Ted Gatzis's family, former state senator, now Manchester mayor, were worried about him this week, but they tell us now he's doing fine. He underwent heart bypass surgery this week.
That's right. We had an initial announcement that he would be undergoing a procedure. There was not any additional information. We now know he had a heart bypass surgery. He's 63. We've heard from his brother that he's resting comfortably, expects a full recovery, and will sort of gradually kind of reintegrate himself into the daily functioning of City Hall.
And here's an email that came in from Robin, who says, I'll give this to you, Kathleen. He says, would the Paycheck Fairness Bill also prohibit pay differences between two men or two women if their jobs and skills, et cetera, were the same? That is, if differences between a man and a woman's pay are unfair, shouldn't the same issues and comparisons apply to any two workers? Robin, it's a great question and one I hadn't thought of.
Yeah, actually, as the bill is written, like I said earlier, there are specific criteria that an employer needs to point to show that there's a reason two people are being paid differently. And that isn't just for men and women. So if a male, two men had the same job, they had the same expertise, they were doing the same thing at work every day,
hired on
the
same
level of education, hired on the same day, and they were making different salaries, yes, I do believe under this bill, they could bring forth a complaint.
Okay. Robin, thanks for the email. And I just want to let everybody know, next week on The Exchange, boy, a tough week. We're going to sit down on Monday with Granite Staters, who were at the Boston Marathon last year on that awful day when two bombs went off at the finish line. And then we're going to be talking to Rwandans, reflecting on the 20th anniversary of the genocide there. So tough stuff coming up next week, but important stories. That's some of what we're up to. Kevin, what are you up to next week?
I'm going to be following the gas tax. You know, Speaker Terry Norelli talked about it in the opening. It's certainly an issue that a year ago didn't look like it was really going to go anywhere. And that this governor was probably was going to talk about spending more money on infrastructure in this next campaign, but not have anything to show for it. It sure looks like she will. This would be a very modest increase, but there's bipartisan support for it. And I think the House will be passing it very soon.
How about you, Dean?
Sure. Gas tax, the death penalty vote next week will be really interesting. I'm also going to see how Scott Brown does in his first week as an officially announced candidate for the Republican nomination.
Okay. And Kathleen, it'll be a busy week for you at the State House, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Actually, there is a domestic violence bill known as Joshua's Law that's going to be coming before House committee next week. It's already passed through the Senate. It is the bill named after the young boy who was killed by his father at a Manchester YWCA last year, and it would create a specific crime of domestic violence or include all those crimes under one domestic violence heading. It actually doesn't create any new crimes. It just makes domestic violence all those crimes categorized together. So that's going to be very interesting. And Joshua's mother is supposed to be testifying before the committee, so very emotional as well.
And, of course, the big, big vote next week, I would say, is the state Senate, full state Senate on death penalty repeal, right?
Yes.
Kevin and Kathleen?
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you, everyone, for being with us. We really appreciate it. Kathleen, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
Kathleen Ronayne, State House and Politics Reporter for the Concord Monitor. Kevin Landergan, good to see you. Thank you.
This was fun.
Kevin Landergan, political reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua. Dean, thank you for being here.
Sure. Thanks, Laura.
Dean Spiliotis is author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, nearly 1 year after the Boston Marathon bombings, we sit down with Granite Staters who were at the race and get their thoughts on how things have changed. Then, 2 decades after the Rwandan genocide, we'll talk with Rwandans from our area about their experiences and hopes for the future. And later, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us all next week for The Exchange, every morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show, next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our listeners, and from Alpha Loft, a co-working space in downtown Portsmouth, servicing the creative tech and entrepreneurial communities of the Seacoast. More details at alphaloft.com. And Centrix Bank, see beyond with Centrix Bank, banking solutions customized to your business, information available at centrixbank.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVU Concord.
89.1. WEVS Nashua.
88.3. WEVH Hanover.
91.3. WEVN Keene.
90.7. WEVC Gorham.
107.1. WEVJ Jackson.
99.5. WEVF Colebrook.
90.3. And WEVQ Littleton.
91.9. And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius resigns after a 5-year term. President Obama says he'll nominate Budget Director Sylvia Matthews Burwell to replace her. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid released physician payment data.